Welcome to Art Bazaar, a podcast that chats with artists of all types to explore the depths of creativity. Brought to you by the Alternative Gallery. We'll be releasing new episodes every Wednesday with bonus episodes dropping randomly. If you like what you're hearing, you can support this podcast by going to thealternativegallery.com and clicking on the podcast tab. I'm your host, Brandon Wonder, creative director of the Alternative Gallery, a nonprofit arts organization in Allentown, PA, run through the efforts of dedicated volunteers. On this episode of Art Bazaar, we'll be talking about film preservation, the Alternative Gallery's growing film archive, and our upcoming screening at the Emmaus Theater titled Dusty Cans. Dusty Cans is an ongoing film screening series of 16mm film prints featuring cartoons, short documentaries, cultural films, musicals, home movies, silent films, and much more. The screenings act as a form of preservation by not only showcasing lost and little-known films, but showing them on their original format. The next Dusty Cans screening takes place this Sunday, January 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Emmaus Theater. Tickets are available on Eventbrite as well as at the box office the day of the screening. Joining me on this episode is Rob Riegel, one of the co-founders of the Alternative Gallery, and his first appearance in Art Bazaar, Alex Enseleski, the head archivist here at the Alternative Gallery. Alex and Rob, thanks for stopping by Art Bazaar.
Howdy.
How you doing, Alex?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good.
How's life and stuff?
Getting by.
Getting by? Fantastic. So I figured let's jump right into it because we got so much cool stuff to talk about. We're going to get right into film preservation. Alex, do you want to start by explaining what film preservation is?
That's kind of a tough question. Well, it's preservation of film.
Yeah. What kind of film?
Well, anyway, what we have is mostly 8mm, 16mm. There's a little bit of 35mm.
We have 8, Super 8, 16, a little bit of 35. But we focus on mostly 8 and 16, right?
Yeah, mostly 8 and 16. So most of the film that we have is going to be probably from like the 40s, 50s, 60s. There's a lot from the 70s. And what happens with a lot of film is that it isn't stable. It's not something that lasts forever. So you're finding a lot of people who have stuff that's, you know, from the 40s and 50s and they're personal collection and starting to go bad. You get something called vinegar syndrome, and you need to keep the film cold and dry to keep that from happening. It's a chemical process, of course.
Yeah, humidity is like the worst enemy of film prints.
Yes, and what happened is in the 70s and 80s, they started using something called polyester film. Now that stuff, if you have a good color base, that will last you thousands of years, theoretically.
Thousands, yeah, and the old film stock
is on something called safety film. So, not to get too technical here, but when 35 millimeter was introduced, that was on nitrocellulose film, which had a tendency of blowing up.
AKA nitrate film.
And it lasted until the 50s, and in 35, believe it or not. But with 16, that was always what they considered safety film. I think it's called triacetate film, technically. And that film, it doesn't blow up, that's good, but it does dissolve over time. So eventually the film will start warping, it will crack, basically all your silver nitrate or color stock will fall off of it, and that's about the end of it. You can't run through a projector. Sometimes if you're careful, you can sort of work it through frame by frame, especially with what we have, which is local stuff. We might be one of a kind things.
We definitely do, especially when you consider the home movies we have. And we do not have nitrate film.
Luckily.
I think you, in fact, need an explosives permit to store nitrate film.
Yeah, well, they liked burning that stuff in the old days, too, for silver content. That's why we have a lot of films that are considered lost films, on the commercial side of things, anyway.
Yeah, I think it's, what, about 75% of all silent films are assumed to be lost forever?
Yeah, Edison burned a lot of them, at least the company, I think.
Well, what happened, too, was when studios went from silence to talkies, they assumed no one was ever going to want to watch silent films again, so they just burned them on lots. And then you had archives, of course, which went up in flames for a multitude of reasons, one of which was because of the nitrate prints they were storing.
Yeah,
we've heard all kinds of horror stories about that. But luckily, every now and then, you hear these film collectors who end up having one of these lost films, or portions, like Metropolis, not even 15 years ago was restored because of a collector having a full print.
And that's the thing with film, is that ironically, even though it's an old process, it's almost like phonograph records, where it's just high enough technology that you get decent quality, but it's also something that you don't need high technology to run to. It's basically just a picture that you can shine a light at and you see it. Whereas if it was digital, you'd have to have a program or software, the hardware, whatever, to actually get to it, which we might not have in 20, 30 years. Even back in the 1940s and 50s, often what happened was that the only prints we have survived because somebody had the mind of actually taking a copy of a kinograph at the time, and it got preserved. It doesn't look like much, but it's there.
It's crude, but it exists.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, it's like there was this one guy, he was alive until a few years ago, he said that the state of TV was basically a great wasteland. There was a lot of junk even back then. I mean, a lot of this stuff is not amazing, but it is context, which if you don't have that, what are you basing your history off of?
I think this is going to be an interesting conversation in general, because you have me as a filmmaker, Alex as a film preservationist and archivist in general, and then you have Rob, who's kind of a tinkerer in all realms, a non-filmmaker, a non-archivist, so it kind of is an outside view. So Rob, I'm curious, out of the time the Alternative Gallery has been spending these last 7-8 years, especially saving and archiving these films, what have you taken from that?
I'm a big appreciator of history, and I'm into like all things antiques and antiquity. So the value in all of that is very clear to me. It's very obvious whether or not it's film, and getting to witness the things on the film itself, you know, like they are memories and images that no one, you know, in some cases, you know, 100 years has seen. And then we get to be a part of that and, you know, make sure that it's going to be around for another 100 years for more people to witness. We watched a small piece of film just before we started recording, and there are people living in the city that didn't even realize that that type of stuff was going on back then. Like, it was about a trolley. There are people that don't realize that they walk right across those trolley tracks every day, not knowing they were ever there. And now we have proof of it. We have a documentation of it. I just think that that's an amazing thing. And I think film is a really interesting tool in that it can capture moments and hold on to them for longer than any human memory.
We're all in our 30s here. And I'm curious, when the last time outside of the gallery, Rob, was it that you had seen something on film?
Actually on film, the last time I can confirm 100% for certain that I had seen something like on film going reel to reel through a projector was high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
So 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids now, they're not exposed to these things. And for us, I think that is another part of the preservation, is not just saving these films, but showing them on these original formats, meaning the film stock and the film projectors, whenever possible. And I think that is an educational tool in and of itself. We have kids that come through here, when they see that the TV wall, they haven't seen those CRT TVs.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't seen VCRs before. They haven't seen VHS tapes before. And they stopped making VCRs not even 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of these kids still have never even been exposed to one. Forget film stock. Forget projectors. Alex and I, we've traveled to all kinds of unique places trying to find some of these cinematic gems. And almost every time, we have to drag out a projector, because even museums sometimes don't have a film projector. It's kind of crazy. So Rob, before the gallery, did you have any kind of awareness of film preservation or kind of what we've come to do in that sense?
I guess if anything, there was probably a general awareness that that kind of thing took place. Like my great grandmother, I was raised with her in my household, and you know, she was very fond of classic movies, you know, black and white stuff. A lot of like the old like religious movies, you know, like I grew up on Ten Commandments and like stuff like that, Samson and Delilah. She would always get the best possible copy she could find, the plastic big box ones that like had that pop when you open the case,
the clamshells.
Yeah, yeah, they would have the little gold band around the box that says like, you know, a limited edition, extended cut, whatever. You know, we would go to Suncoast Video at the mall.
Hell yeah, I love that place.
And she would look for those, like the best possible copy of these old movies that she could find. So like I knew that these were special. I knew that cinema was special, that film in general was highly valued. As far as, you know, people having to preserve these reels in refrigerated rooms and all of this type of stuff, I really didn't realize that that was going on. But yeah, I knew that there was value in it for sure.
Yeah. So we started the archive here, Alex, what, 8 years ago now?
Probably about that.
2016, yeah. 2015 even, maybe 9 years ago almost?
Yeah, back then that was back when it was one room before it got partitioned into the screening wall and the archive, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
That is the room that where everything is.
Now, do you remember those early conversations you and I had about why we wanted to start this? Obviously, something jumped out between these conversations that we agreed, yeah, we got to go find some things and save them and show them.
Yeah, it's like, wow, this is kind of cool. But at the same time, it's not something that people would necessarily... Well, I think a lot of people see film and they're kind of... they don't know really what to do with it. A lot of it is a generation or two before them. And especially where you live, I was thinking along the lines, well, maybe if I can find out something about the place I live, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, I can find out more about, you know, knowledge about what I have right now. And that is an ironic thing about film is that, or history in general, is sometimes having a better knowledge of history prepares you better for what's happening in front of you. I guess that's pretty obvious, really, but
which we never seem to abide by or listen to. You hear that generic saying, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, yet we just ignore it and we don't pay attention. It's not important. It's all about what's coming next. And I mean, you in general, you're someone that's interested in history and you're interested in local history. And I think what really jump started our need to create an archive was when we began to understand that local institutions and libraries did not have archives containing these materials. And things like the Allentown Public Library that once had film prints that you can go and check out, just like you can check out books, movies, music now. Well, once formats changed and film was no longer the format, they sold everything off like they would at book sales. And they have now nothing in their archives, film related, and they have no idea where anything went. So once we started to find out that different institutions no longer had film, we're like, shit, we need to really take this up in a serious way. I think for me, that's where the alternative gallery started getting serious. Alex, would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Now, as far as the library, they may have had a lot of stuff that wasn't really related to Allentown. It may have just been a particular film here or there, or they could have just rented out stuff like they do films right now. Now, it's with libraries, they still have some physical things. I think when you get into digital stuff, ironically, it seems like there was a lot more work done back then to put stuff for future than there is now. Because microfilm libraries, or at least last time I was at the Allentown Public Library, that was pretty substantial. They also have a really good history room. I should probably go there more often, to be honest.
Yeah, the microfilm library is still accessible there, correct?
It is, and there's one in Bethlehem, too. Although, it has to be said, the Morning Call is quite a bit better than the Bethlehem Globe Times as far as historical stuff. Although, I think Bethlehem also has the Morning Call as well. But, again, keeping the stuff, we're interested in keeping the stuff in the public eye, like the library does. What happened to the Morning Call is that, theoretically, they had microfilm collections of stuff that was going all the way back to probably like the 1880s and 1890s. There were about six or seven different newspapers that I think got folded into the Morning Call. And I don't know what happened to that. Tribune bought the Morning Call. Who knows what they did? They could have just sold some site like newspapers.com, which is for profit. It is a matter of education. That's why we're doing this, really.
Yeah, I think what kind of makes Alternative Gallery unique in a certain way is, I know I'm a collector, but we get to collect in a different way where we keep this in the public eye. Where I think of a lot of collectors, they love something, they buy it, and they kind of maybe unintentionally keep it from others because it's not, maybe it's a niche interest and they don't have a lot of people in their lives who are into it. This is where you had a lot of zines and clubs and forums, and now the internet's opened up a lot more where you can access people from all over the world who love this thing you love, but it wasn't always so easy.
That's one of the reasons why torrents, like thinking about.
The Pirate Bay. We can say it. Long live the Pirate Bay.
But at the same time, they're preserving stuff better than a lot of actual museums are because they've distributed a lot of that information around. It's in multiple places. There is a value in having a lot of places like the Alternative Gallery having film archives.
And it's also weird that, you know, we have like lightning fast technology, like technological advancements. But the odd thing is, no current digital formats are future proof. There are currently no digital archiving methods. None. Nothing digital is archival. In fact, Hollywood, when they shoot films digitally now, when they go to put those films in archives, they put those digital films back on film stock. The polyester stocks that Alex mentioned earlier that are supposed to last thousands of years. So it's amazing that we see that, not we, but society at least sees this as such an outdated and dead format, yet it's going to outlast all these new formats that everyone's so crazy about.
Oh, it's funny. It's like if you have a book and you're an author, you want to have it on like paper.
You want to have it in print.
You could have it either way, I suppose, but I think a lot of people would like something like, okay, I did this. I think you have to have a niche interest that people can grab onto and sort of push it forward. Now, it's interesting because you have things like video game archiving, and that's like very expensive to really do right, I think. But you find people who have interest in, like, say, like a particular thing off an 8-bit computer. There's lots of discs with stuff that's been, again, it's the pirates who usually save the stuff for us because they cracked the stuff early on.
Yeah, funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and it's not just that stuff, but it's even you in the last 5-10 years, you see so many lost games or prototypes of games that were abandoned that these so-called pirates or hackers find and then release online.
Although it's shocking to see what actually pops up after a while. I guess it's the same thing with film. Now, of course, you're getting into something that's a lot more complex. You have to have at least the knowledge of what was actually intended for in the first place. If you have a bunch of code, it's like, what's this? So luckily, a lot of the people who are involved with this stuff are still alive for the most part. Whereas with film, you just have to look at it and sort of piece it together with other things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it can be overstated how ironic it is that people see film as a dead medium, yet it's going to outlast all these new digital mediums that people are consuming endlessly right now. There's like something completely lost on people that I think needs to be understood more. This is where our intentions to build an archive really comes from, because a lot of these are discarded. Their materials are just thrown away. It's either they're completely considered like trash, or people think that anything old is worth money. And that's, I think, where we really find ourselves in a pickle, Alex, right? It's difficult to find these materials, and too often when we do find them, they're asking insane amounts of money for it.
Well, I mean, that's one of those things where when we started doing this, nobody really cared about some of the stuff. And it seems like, I don't know, maybe there's a bit of a fear of missing out on this kind of stuff too, because people realize, oh, I've got the only one of these. Well, that doesn't necessarily make it worthwhile, but it makes it a little harder for us to come by the stuff. But at the same time, it's like any form of archaeology. It's like the really true treasures, for the most part, were actually saved, or they got looted by somebody. And this is kind of the problem with a lot of things that are worth money, is that they systematically get sold or stolen or destroyed over time. And then what you're left with is just a sort of contextless detritus.
We take great steps to having an ethical archive. Nothing that we have is stolen or removed from someone without their knowledge or permission. I mean, even today, we acquire two films, home movies of Allentown from the 1930s and 1950s by the son of the man who shot it. And he said his father would have been so happy to know that people still care about what he did and want to continue showing it. And that's really important. Alex, why don't you talk about what we focus on in the archive? Like, what films do we... Because, I mean, there's, like you said to me the other day, there's so much media out there. And our intention isn't just to find every old film print out there. We are specific about what we look for. Do you want to talk about what we look for specifically?
because there is a value sometimes in shotgunning things, because you do come across things you would have never realized. And maybe that's a good thing, just to be knowledgeable about what media is out there, because you become a lot more knowledgeable about things in general. Although at a certain level, it just becomes brain pollution. That's why I try to focus on particular genres, particular eras. And it's kind of fascinating that when the home movie era ends, it's really hard to find anything. Even that's, there's a value in that. When you think about it, you go on Wikipedia, you can find a lot of stuff about Allentown in the 50s and 60s. It starts to become kind of rare in the 70s. You can't find anything from the 80s, unless it's in like a TV archive or something. And the only reason we have anything from the 90s and forward is because that's fairly recent. Personally, I like home movies because there's a lot of surprises in home movies. Well, sometimes. Because a lot of times it's like Christmas or somebody's birthday party. And, you know, there's a little bit of interesting context to be had there, because that's how people lived. That's still interesting in and of itself, but it's not necessarily what I look for. I think with home movies, though, you do get a value that a lot of the stuff you see, it was done with intent, but usually people weren't trying to edit it down. Nobody's trying to sell you propaganda here. This is basically a raw image of what the person saw or wanted you to see, basically.
One of the things you and I have talked about in the past is why home movies are helpful is sometimes, maybe just in the background of a shot or a film in general, you'll have things appear that no one really thought to document.
Yes, and sometimes with that kind of thing, you'd be like, okay, there was a business here. And what did this business do? Oh, well, it was actually part of this neighborhood. And, oh, somebody actually worked here. And how about this interesting thing where people remember that, and then you can get more out of that. And you realize this is actually how neighborhoods actually function in the old days.
And how they still should function.
In many ways.
Human nature has not changed that much that that idea is now completely gone.
And it's a good example how you can basically have these different roles within a neighborhood. I think, especially in a place like Allentown, when you have a lot of specific things from specific people, you get a pretty good standard. I'm not trying to be proselytizing any particular thing here, but for example, you can have like multiple businesses, whereas if it was just like a lot of modern malls, it's one poor guy running a store of like 50 different things, for better or for worse.
Yeah, as a general summary of what our archive focuses on, obviously Allentown-related materials, since that's where we're located, and I think that those materials are so scattered, as you just briefly mentioned. We're fascinated by home movies in general, of all types, just because home movies, especially on film, they're automatically the only one that exists. So the rarity in itself makes it worth seeking out, even if it's not something we decide to hold on to long term. We're very interested in documentaries, cultural films, and animation from specifically the 20s and 30s. And more recently, we've always had this interest, but more recently it's grown, silent films. Now, Alex, why? Now, would you agree that's kind of the breadth of what we focus on mainly?
Yeah. Now, as far as sometimes you get lucky and you can still find old cartoons in 35mm, that's way above our price range.
Yeah. That's out of our pocketbook can't afford that. And Alex, you've made the point too about like, yeah, you can go on YouTube because these animations and stuff like that, they're not the only copies that exist. You can go on YouTube and find some of these films. You can even find some of these films in much better condition than what we have. But the thing is, you probably wouldn't go and seek that film out and watch it specifically.
No, and it's like reading a newspaper. It's sometimes you have to have everything curated in one spot to actually come across something else. Otherwise, it's kind of like everything siloed away. And I think that's why, strangely enough, sites like Reddit are popular, because that's kind of like the catch-all for everything.
Those posters act as curators in a sense.
Yeah, and everything kind of mashes together. Whereas a lot of sites are special interests, they're just that special interest. And after a while, a lot of that isn't sustaining itself. Now, if you have narrow special interest, it can be great. But after a while, you're just getting the same thing about 10 different times.
Yeah.
It's one of those things with the internet in general, is it seems like, I don't want steal Cory Doctorow's thing, but he has the term the enshittification of the internet. We're trying to avoid that, obviously.
We are. So, Rob, going back to the concept, what I just talked about, of finding these films that exist in other places, but you probably wouldn't have thought to watch in your own. Have you experienced that with some of the screenings we've done, or even just while we go through films downstairs in the archive?
I would say pretty much everything that I've seen come out of the archive is something that I wouldn't, like, there's so much of it that I wouldn't have even thought would have existed, that my mind is completely blown every time I start, like, reading titles on cans, or every time we do a small screening between, like, the home movie stuff we saw earlier today, or the, you know, the stuff from Dusty Cans when we had it at the theater. The animated stuff especially, like, that kind of thing is, there's so much creativity and uniqueness in the world that you could never hope and expect to be able to witness all of it. You know that there's more out there than you're ever going to see, but then every time you see something new, it just seems so special. And that, to me, I think is one of the great things about the collection that we have, is that there's so much new, there's a new experience in every can. You know?
Would you say that you have to be a cinephile or history buff to enjoy our selection of films?
No, not at all. I think that you just need to be, if anything, you need to be a little bit open-minded, especially if you're coming to a screening where there's going to be a variety of different film on display. And really, yeah, just, you know, open to entertainment and interested in a sense of how things used to be, whether that is the content that you're actually seeing on the screen, or just the feeling of sitting in a theater, you know, and hearing the clack, clack, clack of the projector in the background and just doing it the good old fashioned way.
Yeah. Willem Dafoe, he had a great quote that I saw recently. He said, yeah, all these people talk about, they don't want to watch these movies because they're old movies. He goes, well, if you haven't seen it before, it's not an old movie.
Exactly, yeah.
I love that point. And I would say that the screenings we do, especially the way we curate them, we're aiming at a general audience. I'm not just going for film buffs. I'm hoping that in addition to general audiences, film buffs will especially go crazy for it, because they'll pick up on some of the things we're peppering in that some people might not pick up on. Mm-hmm. Right, Alex?
Yeah, well, I try to put some cheap thrills in there too.
Well, yeah, make it fun, make it lively. Now that we've come to this point talking about what we have and kind of why we collect it, why is what we have worth saving?
That's a broad question.
It is a broad question. Is it better to just let it rot somewhere and we save our money and our time?
Well, sometimes you feel like that when you see some of these things. But no, seriously though, like I was saying before, it's like it's important to have the stuff for contextual reasons. It is also worth having, again, a physical copy of it, because as far as Google is, they pretty much kill everything after a little while. Now, YouTube's probably in better shape, but the thing is, what's going to happen when you have so much data on the server that you have to purge something? It's going to be like a user probably has like a bunch of stuff they may have put up about like 5 or 10 years ago, even 15 at this point, and it just becomes lost.
Yeah, because we were talking at one point too about how Google was starting to purge accounts on YouTube of inactive users.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff that if you sometimes go to links and they're dead links, and that's the nature of the internet.
I would assume too with the age of a lot of this content, those users who maybe did manage to upload it to YouTube, they're probably not the youngest. They're probably not in their 30s like us. So they're going to, for lack of a better word, go inactive eventually. Eventually
something happens.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And another thing to think about too is that once something is online, it can be edited, it can be watered down, it can be hidden. One thing that crossed my mind when you guys were just discussing this too is like the cultural films that we have down there. What happens if that culture doesn't exist one day in the relatively near future and somebody with a lot of power and importance decides that, you know, the world didn't really need to know much about that culture existing? Well, YouTube and Google and then, you know, the various, you know, search engines online, like it's easy to get that stuff wiped. All you need is a good lawyer and a little bit of money.
Yeah, it gets dystopian after a while. I mean, if you really follow that to end conclusion.
Well,
because there's a lot of stuff that, honestly, people would probably be ashamed to have, or there would be ashamed having it. Honestly, that's still cultural history. It's one of those things that, well, I mean, depends where you want to draw a line, really.
Well, there's two important points I want to make here. The first is that I like what you just said, Rob, about, you know, maybe some force or power wants to undo or hide or erase. I think one of the reasons why our archive is so important is I don't know what's going to happen in the future. We see films that have been altered. It's easy to alter any of these things. For us to keep a physical copy, an original copy, we can say, hey, they changed this. This is not what it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
My main driving force behind this archive, if the rest of the world stopped existing, we would have this beautiful record of what humanity did and what humanity was. I think that's why archives are so essential. But at the same time, for a true archive to live up to its value, it needs to not work alone, which is why you should work with other archives, try to store certain copies of your stuff with them, ask them to have their copies with you. That way, God forbid, if there's ever a fire or if you digitize and the server is just lost or wiped out or whatever the case may be, you have another copy. The other point I want to make is going back to what we were just talking about things being on YouTube. Now, when we talk about film preservation and archiving, for most people, their mind would go back to films from the 20s and 30s, these old films and things like that, right? Okay, well, that's what's looked at right now to archive from the past. But what's being made today, one day will be just as necessary to save and archive. And because I don't see as much of an importance placed on that, we're already losing tons of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to lose more than ever because the ease to create media and access media has made it so that there's way more media than there ever was before. And that's probably going to continue that direction for a long time. So again, these inactive accounts, what happens if someone's like a student filmmaker or an amateur filmmaker? How many artists have painted masterpiece after masterpiece and died an unknown artist, but after they passed away, they're this famous artist? The same is going to happen with short animations, with documentaries, with filmmaking of all types. So to be able to access and have this information saved now is going to be so invaluable to people of the future. And I think part of what we do with these old films is not to just give a peek into the past. Yes, that's nice, but I want to highlight that we need to do the same for what we have today. Many times I've told people, I said, just imagine right now, if I can sit you down in these chairs and screen home movies from ancient Egypt, how powerful that would be. People then understand the importance of those home movies we have.
Mm-hmm.
But because they're from the 40s and 50s, okay, well, that's old, but it's not that old. But one day, those home movies will be just as important as the home movies from ancient Egypt. And if we start looking at it that way now, then we're going to have a lot more saved in the future. You're going to have a lot less of the need for the Martin Scorsese's of the world to go out and find these lost films. It shouldn't be a specialized thing. We should be showing people that, hey, look at these amazing things people are creating. Let's save them so future generations can see them, learn from them, and simply just enjoy them.
It is a funny thing, though. It's like, especially with 50s and 60s, a lot of that stuff is pretty ubiquitous. And it's a kind of ironic thing that mid-20th century culture in America is, I guess that was a peak of, I guess, the American dollar and our sort of, the American era. So in the future, that stuff's going to be pretty common. It's probably going to be like people coming across junk from the Roman Empire, really. It should be interesting how people look at that a thousand years from now.
That'll be more common than things from the early 2000s, 50 years later.
Yeah, which, that's kind of messed up too. It's like I was telling you that one time, it's like, I wonder if people are going to look at people who were born like the 70s and 80s and look at these pictures and be like, huh, the only pictures we have of you guys are like babies and old men. It's like something out of like the 19th century or something, when photography was new.
Well, even think about a floppy disk camera, which just came out 20 years ago, 2003, I believe it came out.
Yeah.
Good luck trying to access those photos now.
Although it's funny with the ubiquity of digital, though, is that you get this, the opposite thing happens. And sometimes the physical thing, even though it's not, you're not going to see many people wanting the physical thing, but it seems to retain some kind of value. Like if I were to go on the street corner or something and I had like a 8x10 camera and I take a picture of something, nobody's going to be going out of their way to buy that from you. However, that's going to have some value to somebody down the line. Now, you could say that about like some pictures you take out of your phone, but you're not going to have that, obviously, unless you've figured out some system of printing it and make it save forever. But that's getting into the weeds there.
So I want to talk about something that I get asked a lot when it comes to our film archive. People ask us where we find things. Where do we find things, Alex? How do we come across these films?
Well, you find it from people trying to make a quick buck. You find it from people who are throwing stuff away. Sometimes you, well, let's see, what's the craziest way I found things? I think what got me started on this weird film thing was I always did photography in high school. That's one reason why it's probably a good thing to do things like this in school, because you actually know what the stuff is.
Again, education is so important.
Yeah. So I'll throw a little pitch in here too. Nazareth High School actually has a really good film program, and I think they're still running it. My photography teacher, her name was Nikki Steger, and actually I learned quite a bit there, but I wasn't a very good photographer. But to get back to this whole thing, one day I was going to this wedding, and I figured, okay, I have all this free time here in between the event and like other things. I'll just drive down the road and see what I can find. Maybe there's a yard sale or something. So I'm driving down to Kutztown, and here's this house, some younger guy, well, youngish. He's like in his 40s. Obviously, somebody died. So I'm looking at this stuff, and he's got a bunch of good cameras outside, and I'm looking at these cameras, and they're kind of rare lenses, too, and they're East German cameras. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, these are Contax cameras. This was obviously a photographer who knew what he was doing. And for whatever particular reason, I was like, "Ah, man, you got any film?" "Oh, yeah, I got a bunch of film, man."
Now, were you talking about photographic film or motion picture film?
Well, he had both. And if I had known better, I would have been all over his slides. But he's like, "Oh, yeah, well, here's some stuff." So he comes back with this box, and I'm looking at it, and there were a bunch of home movies. They said, you know, like New York, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, okay, that looks kind of cool. And then he had a ton of porn. I was like, okay, that's cool too. So I buy it, and I'm kind of looking at these pictures, and I'm like, wow, it's kind of dirty. What kind of guy was this?
How much you want for everything?
$10. So I was like, cool. That's actually kind of a worthwhile thing. But I didn't have any equipment to actually watch the stuff for a while. So, you know, I just put it aside. I mean, what was I going to do with the porn? But I sold it, so. But I kept the films because I was like, and you know, I'm sure there's a porn collector out there because that's culture too.
In its own way, absolutely.
Yeah. Usually filmed out of some guys like a trailer or something. But besides the point, so here's a bunch of random films. And most of the time, honestly, this kind of stuff can just be very common. I mean, you can sometimes go and find a video of this stuff online and you get the general idea. But this got more interesting because it was actually somebody's life, and they were a little bit more interesting to other people. I hate to say it like that, but they were. Like, you could see a family, and you could actually see, you know, this is actually an American family. They have a lot of interesting ideas, and how should I word this here?
Well, so, I mean, like, going back to the original question here of where we find these things, you don't go on Amazon.com to find these films.
No.
And you don't go to Target to find these films.
Well, they are, a lot of them are personal. And
well, that's home movies.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is going through these films, when I actually found out, is that that was an interesting era in American history, too, because you're talking about the 40s, like 30s, 40s, 50s. And that was when, say, somebody was actually in the war. And as it turns out, it wasn't just like New York stuff. These were actually extremely well-shot films. Probably a very high-level amateur, which I kind of surmised that from the cameras that the guy had out there. But the films themselves, they were shot well. Then they went back to Reading. That really got interesting because you got to see Reading Fair. You got to see crowds. You got to see the conveyances and how people got around. And then it turns out the guy's kid actually took a lot of camera studies as well For example, there was one where it was Korean War. You had a bunch of stuff from a MASH camp. That's not what you expect, but that was the era when people would actually be doing stuff like that. A little bit of Japan. I couldn't believe it. They went to the Peace Memorial in Hiroshima, and here's some guy who has like scars all over his body. He may have done that for thousands of people, but maybe this is the only copy that survived.
Yeah, and I would say these materials are becoming more and more scarce.
I will go even further. It's like with as far as some of the stuff is that you actually, one way or another, sometimes you can see how people thought about things politically. It's not filtered through a textbook or a website where it seems like ideologues are everywhere.
Yeah. So, Rob, someone that, you know, isn't seeking these materials specifically, how often do you see these or come across these films?
I mean,
and you go to a lot of flea markets and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, flea markets, antique stores, I do quite a bit of that. And it is extremely rare that you'll find anything, like, even remotely like what we have here. Like, at most, maybe you'll find a box of old, like, slides, you know, the individual slides that go on the projector. But, yeah, as far as films, no. No, maybe you'll see, like, an old camera, but the film itself, hardly ever.
Even if you find a camera that still has film in it unprocessed, it's getting even difficult to find a processing plant. There's so few left in America.
Yeah.
Which, again, there's a need for that stuff. And that's one of the services we would like to eventually offer, because we want to be able to have a family walk in these doors. They discover, oh, my grandfather had this camera and passed away a few years ago, and we don't know what's on it. You might have one of these gems, like Alex was just explaining. But I think for us, outside of luck, it is just like pure detective work having to find these things. We just got lucky recently. I was browsing around on eBay, not even looking for Allentown films, and happened to find footage of the last day the trolleys were running in Allentown. That's what we watched earlier tonight. And like, again, I wasn't even looking for Allentown films, but here it is. And I look at it. I look at the seller, happens to be in Bethlehem. I message him. And we make contact, we're talking, long story short, we went, we got the films, the guy's dad shot it, he has a fascinating story, his dad has a fascinating story, so you might get lucky and find these places and find these people that are close to you, but more often than not, you're not finding these things. I mean, how many times have we walked people through our building or our archive and they said, "Ah, I wish I had met you sooner. Because my family cleared out my grandparents' place and we threw it all away." Because I feel what happens so often with these outdated technologies is families get overwhelmed when a loved one passes away. And they're cleaning out. Sometimes they have a deadline to have a place cleaned out by. And they don't know what to do with home movies or maybe even sometimes photos. And they just throw it away. And think about that. You're not only losing family history, you're potentially losing local history to wherever that came from. And that's one of the big things we're trying to avoid. And I find ourselves more and more often having to go out to flea markets and yard sales and specialty things. Like, Alex, do you ever remember at the Kutztown radio show there ever being motion picture film?
I think I remember once some guy showed up with a projector.
But no film?
Don't remember any film. Oh, yes, there was.
Really?
Actually, it was from... yeah, but it was in such horrible shape, I couldn't do anything with it.
And that's another thing. If these films aren't stored properly, they deteriorate very quickly. And what happens with the things you don't want? Where do they go? They go in the basement, the attic, or the garage.
Yep.
And again, like we talked about it earlier, the two worst things to film is heat and humidity. Alex, how fast does film break down? What between temperature and humidity?
If you go online, you can see like data sets basically at normal humidity and normal temperature. You can probably get about 100, 120 years out of film if you're lucky. Now, if you're running, like the one guy we met today, he said he was in Vietnam and he said he had a lot of stuff that was just wasted. Like the film fell apart as soon as he opened it. And that's because when you get up to, like...
That's 100% humidity.
Yeah, so you're getting up to about, like, 90 degrees at, like, 80% humidity. You're going to see that film probably start to decay within 20 years.
Yeah, film that he had just shot, he said he had to put it in a sealed plastic bag and put it in the creek to keep it cool. That's fascinating, but terrifying. And I think it makes our job a lot more difficult.
Now, you can slow it down quite a bit by just having in a dry spot. And I forget what the exact numbers are, but you can make it last probably 1,000 years if you freeze it. So, like anything else, you can find like probably woolly mammoths that you can eat. Probably melting right now.
I wouldn't recommend that, but I get your point. So what we do here in our archive is we have a very crude, environmentally controlled setup where we suck the moisture out of the air and we use kind of a higher-powered air conditioning unit to keep it cool. But even that is only going to slow it down. And Kodak has spent decade upon decade trying to figure out how to reverse film decay, which is the actual chemical breakdown of the film stock. And Kodak has essentially thrown in the towel and said, it can't be done.
So what Kodak does, they put out a couple products. They're basically almost like silica gel things where you're really supposed to change them out after 2 years or so, but they're really expensive. Last time I bought them, they were 6 bags for $350, and that was, I'm still basically going through supplies because I froze some and kept them sealed. And there are also other things that have come on the market, too. I think they're called AB strips, so it tells you how much off-gassing. So to get into the chemistry of this, which I've kind of failed chemistry, by the way. So what happens is that film, triacetate, when it breaks down in the vinegar smell that you smell, that's actually acetic acid. So if you've ever worked in a dark room and smelled fixer, that's basically the same thing. That's why you could basically take a photograph and put it in vinegar, and that would fix the photograph for the most part. But that's what happens when it decays. And these strips that are sold can tell you how far off that is, because when it starts to decay, it kind of goes like in a logarithmic curve. So,
but in general, this is just telling you how far gone your film is. It's doing nothing to slow it down or stop it.
No, and the best thing, like I said, you can try to keep it cold. Now,
yeah, like again, Kodak has failed to stop it. All you can do is slow it down. That's it.
It may be a little bit of a old wives' tale with some of the older photographers, but there's certain people who seem to have the idea that, because early on, I noticed some of the early Kodak cans actually had a little insert, which seemed to have like a little camphor in it. And a lot of those prints actually didn't hold up, which camphor is actually a weird thing because that keeps film in almost a level of softness. So,
and some film stocks fade quicker than others.
Yeah, so everybody knows what Kodachrome is. You know, it's stupid, that song and all that.
Kodachrome was king.
You know, it's one of those things. I suppose you can probably get a pretty good ersatz digital look of Kodachrome now. But Kodachrome actually has phenomenal archival qualities. And Ektachrome's pretty good, too. The slide formats we had were good for that kind of thing. Black and white, as long as the base is good, that should last for a very, very long time. Now, color photography is kind of a tricky thing. Color, like Agfa had their process, which those don't look too good. What happened when they started getting away from Technicolor, which was an interesting process too. I won't get into that too much.
But in general, like you said, black and white film prints, they hold their color pretty well.
Yeah.
A lot of prints, they start to go red.
Well, one of the reasons.
And then things like Kodachrome, they actually hold on to their color, very, very rich color. And even a lot of prints we see now in Kodachrome, they look just as great as the day they were shot.
But that was a very expensive process.
Yes.
Whereas, like Technicolor, if you did like theatrical Technicolor, it was like so expensive because basically you were having three separate cameras almost. And then you just basically tinted each one. I'm not sure exactly how I did it, but it was something along those lines. Three-strip Technicolor versus two-strip, which was like this weird half-color.
But when combined, they were so beautiful.
Which, the concept's been around for a while, but they got away from that in the 60s or 70s. Now, Kodak came out with this process called Eastman color, I think in the 50s or 60s. And it's like, if you look at old photographs from the 60s and 70s, it's like the red era. Because what would happen is that this was such a crappy process that it would start fading within like 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
If it got any heat on it, it would just turn red as a beet. And I think what happened was in the 80s, that's when Kodak was like, oh, we've got a real problem here. This is not good for our reputation. And that's when you start seeing color get good again. But there was this era of just, I guess you could say, a lot of things were cheap.
And we have a variety of all of these things in our archive, except for Technicolor. We don't have any Technicolor in our archive.
There's one or two Technicolor things, but it's...
A 35, yeah.
There are a few 16 millimeter Technicolors.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, Disney liked doing Technicolor prints, and I don't know what they sold them to. They also did Eastman Color, because obviously you weren't going to send like high cost prints to like every school in America. But some of the better copies of this stuff, I suppose, were probably being sent to small theaters and things like that. Maybe it was like a film collector back then. There's always people like that somewhere.
I want to talk about the needs of our archive. You know, we run this archive with no official funding. We were, you know, successful last year in raising $5,000 to save a bunch of film prints, which we found essentially in a junkyard. That's where you find this stuff too often anymore. Aside from that, we've never gotten a grant or any funding to build or maintain this archive. It's kind of been, for the most part, out of whatever money Alex and I are spending. And I don't got money like that. Alex doesn't have money like that. So it's whatever things we could afford to buy at that time. And we essentially donate it to the gallery. And the other items we've gotten have been out of pure luck. People contacting us because they have these things and they know we're into it. And will we like them? And that is essentially how we've built this archive. It's been very Frankenstein. It's been very DIY. I think throughout the duration of this conversation, hopefully we've made it obvious that we want this to be a serious archive and we want it to be an accessible archive. And in order for that to happen, we need certain things. Like you said, those sieves, we need the sieves to put inside the film cans to keep the film maintained with moisture.
Yeah, with film, you also have to repair it once in a while.
That's so like splicing material.
Cans.
We want to... So those metal cans actually trap in the air, which makes it bad for the film.
My theory, too, is that I'm not sure if there's anything behind this, but I've always noticed that, especially rusty cans, those things will always have a bad print in there. I'm guessing that the oxidation probably has something to do with kick-starting the film got bad,
too. Yeah. Yeah, the breakdown of the stock. And there are actually archival cans now which are meant to extend the life of film prints by letting them, because you don't want to just have them sit out. That's not great either. It's actually better to have them stored in these archival cans. So those are things that we're seeking, but they're pricey. They're like $10 a piece for one print.
I mean, obviously, having a place to put the prints there cold enough, that's a big thing.
Yeah, we want to upgrade our storage an environmentally sound system that we have built. And then we opened up a second archive last year, a second room, that we want to completely redo as far as our environmentally controlled system.
I mean, if I had cost no object system, I would be wanting to find a way to digitize these prints in a good way, not some cheap way. And then the best of the stuff, maybe put that on a longer lasting format, like the S-Star film polyester.
Yeah, and that's where we're at right now, where we have tried to get some cheaper, lower-end digitizing equipment, and it's been crappy. The results have been awful. And we've looked into something like the Kinograph, which is kind of like a DIY, build-it-yourself film digitization system, but it requires kind of like an engineering mind and certain, you know, qualifications or at least talents in engineering, which Alex and I lack. Especially me. I think Alex could do it if he applied himself. I would just get too frustrated. I'm not a technical person in that way. And then you have something like the Blackmagic Intel scanner, I believe it is, which is $35,000, which would be amazing for us. But again, without a grant or some angel investor who believes in what we're doing, not going to happen. But I think that is the next step, aside from simple upgrades to the archive, Alex, right, is being able to digitize these films, right?
Yeah.
And then, like you said, put them on new film stock. And like we said earlier in this conversation, even things that are digital are not archival. So for me, it's about, okay, of course, duplicating and copying, making backups of what we already have. But I'm a filmmaker and I shoot my stuff digitally. I want to put my stuff on film stock just for the longevity. I think we should be looking at stuff online and on YouTube and either reaching out to these creators, or if we feel it's a dead end and it's up to us, we pull this stuff offline and we save it ourselves in the hopes that the future will care about it and use it in some proper way. I think that is the big, big goal that we're trying to reach, Alex, correct?
I would say so.
Rob, how do you think that would be valuable to the future, being able to duplicate these materials?
I mean, like we talked about it earlier, you know, the more copies are available of these things in safe spaces, the more likely it's going to be that the future is going to be able to benefit from them, or that people are going to have them available at the very least. And we don't know what's going to be important in the future. We really, truly do not. So,
very good point.
Like Alex said, we have to keep the best stuff, but at the same time, you kind of have to keep that open mind of like, it's the best stuff to us now, but also what may be important in the future. So the more of it that can get preserved and the more diverse formats, the more people that have these things stored properly and saved, the more likely it's going to be that the world can benefit from them later.
Well, I think as artists, too, we recognize what is worth curating and worth keeping for the future.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an important point right there that I was going to say anyways is, for me, it's not just important saving these for historical context or for future research, but having these materials available to filmmakers and artists, I think, is invaluable. Look at something like archive.org, the stuff that you can find on there that would have potentially been lost to time.
I mean, I'm sure some people probably wish some of that was lost to time, but at the same time, it's the only thing we have for a lot of things. Like, think of all the sites that died when GeoCities went down.
Yeah, the Wayback Machine, which lets you access snapshots of the internet at certain times.
And it turns out for a lot of niche things, it's almost like some of the lost video games we were talking about earlier. Some of these things are the only record you can find about people talking about these things when it happened. Like, you want to look up like a review of a game on an enthusiast website, that's where you're going to find it.
So Alex, if you were able to ask anyone listening to help support the archive and our film preservation efforts, what would you ask them for?
Money?
Money. How much money?
Give us $1 million.
That'll be a hell of a donation, I'll tell you what.
And I would say for our needs, a couple thousand here or there wouldn't hurt. Again, we've been doing it kind of on a Frankenstein basis.
Which only gets you so far.
Yeah. And only so fast.
Yeah.
I think that's,
yeah, it's been slow going.
Yeah. So it does sort of roll itself together a little like a Katamari, but at the same time.
Nice reference.
Yeah. Like, you can screen this stuff to a few people at a time, but honestly, we would like to screen this to maybe a couple thousand people at a time on, like, something like a YouTube. We can still have the original content, but without having the digitization stuff, we can't do that.
Yeah.
At least not the way we want to. We could, like, do it kind of a crappy way, like, with, like, a phone camera or something.
Yeah, which we've experimented with all that stuff, and we've agreed it's not the way to go.
No, especially now.
We've even done crude telecines where just like almost reference files, you'll play films in the projector, I set up my camera, that way, God forbid anything happens to those prints, at least I have a 4K digital backup. But because it's not the controlled environment and we're using, let's be honest, not high-end projectors, we're not getting the image quality that really makes it archival.
Yeah, it's like if you want look at something online, it's like, yeah, you can find like some VHS copy that's kind of fuzzy, but we don't want to present that to the world because honestly the quality of the prints are much better than you would think.
Yeah,
especially like the slides, it's like, wow, this is still almost like state of the art. This was meant to be blown up across a big screen.
Absolutely. What you were saying, it ties into the screening we're doing because we have ambitions to obviously not just do in-person screenings, but to show things to wider audiences, like you just explained. But I think in order to get there, it's important we do these smaller screenings and work our way up. So we had actually held a screening back in November over at the Emmaus Theater with the films that we were able to save last year called Dusty Cans, which was just like a joke title at first because we couldn't think of a proper title. And we're like, ah, Filthy Cans, Dusty Cans. Like, let's just go with that. And people kind of liked it. So we're like, all right, well, we want to have this ongoing series where we actually curate blocks of 16 millimeter prints in this case and show people what we have in our archive. Now, that screening was just the films, aside from the little things, little tidbits, little secret things we put in to pepper it up there. But overall, that was just films we had saved through that fundraiser. This screening is different because while some of those films might be in there that we saved last year, it's not dependent just on those films. It's a little bit of everything from the archive. Alex and I have talked about in the past, one of the things we would like to do is, Amaze Theater is amazing. We want to make that kind of our second home, so to speak, with these screenings. We've even talked about getting a dedicated projector, a 16 millimeter theatrical projector to keep at Amaze Theater so we don't have to lug our gear out there, which is what we do this weekend. We actually take out our own sound system and our projectors and our films. But that's only going to work for so long. But what we would like to do eventually is to kind of perfect this idea of Dusty Cans and take the show on the road and do in-person film screenings paired with a talk. And how is that going to be helpful to our mission here?
Well, when you show somebody something, it's like if you throw a random video at somebody, they might not really have any education about what it's about. They might be like, okay, that's fine. Now, you can really give direction to something if you give a explanation of what it's all about. I think a perceptive mind could probably pick up some things, but you might not have the knowledge of what it really is. So there's a film, it's probably sitting in one of the refrigerators downstairs. It's one from Japan. And you look at it and you wouldn't know really where it is. You know, it just looks like random stuff. But then you realize, oh, this was actually in the occupation of Japan. And this was actually an American soldier being shown around, like the temples and the forest and stuff like that. And then it becomes a very interesting thing, which if you didn't know that, you know, it would just be something else. But that actually gets into a lot of things you wouldn't really think of. Like that's basically how relationships were between people. What kind of things that the occupation guys were doing, perhaps on their downtime. And then you can kind of extrapolate it from that, thing.
And I think, too, why it's important to see things in theaters is, you know, in an age of streaming and even home movies where you can pause, rewind, whatever, you can't do that in a theater. You're not in charge of what's playing on screen. So it forces you in a different way to pay attention. Because if you don't pay attention or if you walk away, you missed it. You can't rewind it. And I think that's why the theater experience is never going to go anywhere. It's just not. No matter how many times people say it's going to die, how many times have people said that movie theaters were going to die? I mean, television, movie rental stores, torrenting, Netflix, pandemic. I mean, that's just to name a few.
Well, the important thing is that obviously with like YouTube, you have YouTube comments, people can sort of like put together things. Now, there's an interesting thing where you have a crowd of people at the theater, and they can actually come up to conclusions on their own if they talk to each other. It is still a communal thing, which obviously if you're just watching it in bed, you know, you're not getting the same thing.
Correct. Rob, how do you think these Dusty Can screenings can help us reach our goal to growing our archives and making these materials accessible long-term?
I mean, well, making them accessible, I think that kind of solves itself. But I think one of the greater things, too, is that it's going to help to create more awareness around the archive itself and around the kind of content that we're looking for. So hopefully, you know, if we have someone who's interested in film, hears about the screening, comes out to the screening and realizes, hey, I've got some stuff that's kind of, you know, might be going bad. I might not be able to take care of it long term. Maybe I should get in contact with the gallery. It's going to show a good example of what we have the capability to do right now. And if anyone else out there is interested in it, you know, it's going to give them an opportunity to reach out and say, hey, I really like what's going on here. I'd like to help out. I'd like to be a part of it.
You know, what you just said reminded me of something. A few years ago, it was probably a year, maybe about a year before the pandemic, Alex and I did a screening at the Allentown Public Library. And because of that screening, there was someone there in attendance who actually had old films of Allentown. Remember that, Alex?
Yes, and that there's a lot of interesting things that connect to that, too.
Yeah. So literally just doing one random screening, we didn't think anything of it. Maybe people would like it, want to support the gallery. We did not expect to find even materials more significant than what we were showing that day.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the outcome of it.
Yeah.
And that was just because someone was interested. It was a young person who liked local history, Allentown history, thought what we were doing was great, and thought this was the perfect home for this. Which also reminds me of another thing, Alex. the Louis Buehler films.
Yeah.
You want to talk about those very briefly? Who Louis Buehler was and what his films were?
So Louis Buehler owned a furniture factory on Front Street. But
here in Allentown.
Yeah. And he, I've noticed this with a lot of people who are in town. It seems like there is something interesting about town life in general. And this guy really went out of his way to find what he thought was interesting, and was interesting at the time, and film it. So there's all sorts of interesting films going all the way back to the 30s, but he went even further, and he did a lot of films of Lehigh County, which unfortunately we don't have. But for example, you can see a lot of cultural things. He was very interested in trolleys. I think a lot of the history of trolleys we have around here is off of stuff from his archive. The stuff that interest us especially is the films that he did around the city. I don't know if they were just for family or what, but he did like things that you would see like in the news. Like there was a Japanese submarine that was actually put in Central Square. That's interesting. West Park back in the 40s, which I don't know how many people actually had footage of that. He was very systematic about it, and you can sort of figure out a lot of things from that. Like, oh, look at this. This is our public transit system back then. This is how the industrial stuff was here at one time. Like, even things like floods, natural things. I thought some of the most interesting stuff he had was basically going out into Lehigh County, going to these auctions or the harvest home things that happened around Thanksgiving. Because Lehigh County really hasn't changed a whole lot when you really get down to it. And
you see it in good color, it's a lot more immediate. It really wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, and us getting these films was actually more of a case of good detective work than it was luck. Because I heard a rumor that these films were sitting in the archive of another institution within Lehigh Valley. And I started prodding and asking questions, and I found it to be true. And we lucked out by, and this is where the luck comes in, by finding the right person that understood what we were trying to do. And these films had been sitting there in an archive for 30 years or more, untouched, unwatched, until we showed up. One of the cases, we brought a projector out. We were blown away immediately by what we had found. We were blown away by the number of films we had found. And long story short, because of the relationship with this person that we were able to maintain and grow, they believed in us enough to rehome those films, which are now in our archives, which we now take out when we can to show them. And more importantly, we aim to digitize and make accessible and do screenings with even wider audiences. So I want to get in, because we're running out of time here, I want to get into the upcoming screening that we're doing at the Emmaus Theater this weekend. Alex, are there any films specifically that you want to talk about from this screening that you want to highlight? I know we watched that Zeppelin film last night. You said
yes. So to make a long story short, we can't use our usual projector in Emmaus Theater because it doesn't have enough light.
The projector that we use in our archive to view films is not powerful and bright enough for the screen at the Emmaus Theater. So we had to get this other very oddball projector, which we're hoping is kind of like a bridge projector, to a better one in time.
Yes,
to make it work.
Another Frankenstein projector.
Yeah.
This is how we do things here. And it works. It works well, but you have to make sure a film is in very good shape, because it was really meant for, I think it was probably for airplanes, where you could just put like a very nice new print. And
yeah, it was for new stuff.
Yeah. So when you get back to the 20s and 30s, you start coming across things that are not in great shape. Let's just put it like that.
Old and beat up.
Yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, a lot of stuff from the 20s and 30s, you can see interesting things. Like, for example, a Zeppelin film. It's a Graf Zeppelin. I think that's the one that... Oh, no, the Hindenburg was the one that blew up. But the Zeppelin going around the world. And this film has to be from the 20s. That's about at the beginning of Kodak safety film. So here's this thing going around. Most of the special effects are very Monty Python-esque. But
yeah, the map traveling around the world, almost like Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And then it stops a city after city worldwide, and it gives us a glimpse of what the world was at that point.
Which was very, you can see a transition between cultures there, and even in America, because you have this Zeppelin that's just floating around. This is a very romantic way of travel. And then you're looking down at the U.S., which is, you know, just another stop along the way around the world. And you can see how America was set up back then. You're going over Chicago. Everything's grids. I'm sure if you went over Chicago now, there's a lot of, like, cul-de-sacs and stuff because things have changed. The car has come around. And in a way, it's like seeing a bit of a pre-industrial world. You can see that with certain films that are older like that. And a lot of times, a lot of cartoons that also I'm going to try to show. Oftentimes, you can find stuff on YouTube, but usually it's in not such great shape. It's usually a dupe of a dupe of a dupe.
Yeah,
it's,
we have found prints in our archive to be of better quality than what is available commercially.
And usually what happens is that you end up with something that was probably duplicated for TV about a million times. And honestly, those are sometimes the only copies that exist of that particular cartoon. This yeah. guy, like, and now is probably the last time you're going to find the stuff out in the wild before it's gone forever.
Yeah, and we have a nice array and mix of things. We have some musicals. We discovered that great silent comedy short, Big Boy. Juvenile comedies about this kid, almost like Dennis the Menace, but way more entertaining, way more slapstick. We found a Charlie Chaplin print in our archive, which we had never seen until last night or recently. And that film is a very, very, very early Charlie Chaplin from 1914. This film is 110 years old. And when we say these films are silent, like, they are silent. There's no soundtrack. So I've been going around and finding old music scores from silent films. So when we play these films, there's music to accompany it.
Well, that's good. That way, no, we're not just going to be sitting in the theater listening to the...
Well, it's like I told Alex, you know, even though these films are over 100 years old, everyone is fascinated by them. And Alex said, well, yeah, as long as they're not totally silent. So the music makes a big difference.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's funny. You can sometimes find the stuff on YouTube, too, as you can find everything. Now, some of the stuff does exist, and usually in pretty good copies. Sometimes you have to really trawl for it, too. Now, what we're doing, we're going out and actually showing this to a variety of people.
Yeah, who's going to sit there at home and watch a part of a Charlie Chaplin film from 1914? Almost nobody. But every single person that sits in that theater and watches it, I promise you, you will love it. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where you have cool things that are scattered around, but we say, this is cool. It's usually pretty cool.
And this is why curation's important. You know, you want to point to the things that you think people should be looking at. And if you're able to make this screening, you're supporting a number of things. Number one, you're supporting the Amaze Theater, which is, in my opinion, it's the best theater in the Valley. It's independently owned, which is super important. Like, we need more independently owned movie theaters. I've even told Bobby, the theater owner, my ambitions of reopening the Franklin Theater here. And I didn't sugarcoat it. I said, look, dude, when I reopen the Franklin Theater, the theater I want it to be most like in the Valley is yours. And most people would be like, dude, we're in competition now. He didn't take it that way. He loved it because he's a guy that understands that having the Franklin Theater open would actually complement what he does and help him. Working together, both of those theaters will be mega successful. So number one, you get to support the Emmaus Theater. Number two, you get to support the Alternative Gallery. Number three, you're getting an incredible show out of it for $10. I mean, we're pulling out films that Alex and I have spent our own money on and we've been lucky enough to have donated in addition to. And it is also, and I think maybe most importantly, supporting our archival efforts. I hope we've made it apparent why it's important to archive these films. And if these screenings are well attended and people like it, we'll do them more frequently. We'll more easily have the ability to get that dedicated projector for the Emmaus Theater, which we would like to make, like I said, our second home for these screenings. And that will put us on a path to being able to travel with these screenings and making a bigger impact with what we're trying to do. Anything you guys would like to add to that statement there?
Well, if you want to see something unique, not something that's corporate, this is something that individuals put together.
This is not sanitized.
That's right, DIY for the kids.
It's so unsanitized that literally the name Dirty is basically in the titles, Dusty Cans. You got to get a little bit of that dirt on your hands. It's just like the American Pickers, Farm Fresh. That's where you find a lot of the best stuff.
And usually it's individuals with intent,
yeah,
which is the most interesting stuff. And that's what a lot of the stuff is.
Yeah, and for anyone out there that would like to support what we're doing, the Indiegogo campaign that we ran last year is still active. You can still donate to it. You can find it on our website. You can also find it in the show notes of this episode. That is going to be an ongoing thing. You can also make a donation directly to the Alternative Gallery. Those that did support the fundraiser this past summer and have a perk level that they had gotten, that will be available for pickup at this screening on Sunday. If you're not going to be there, if you can't make it, we'll arrange for it to be shipped out to you. And some great merch will be available there, too, for anyone who might want to come and check it out and get yourself some nice swag. I know Rob was rocking his Save the Films shirt the other day.
Yo, I'm loving it. And because I got, like, first pick, I got that really cool, like, dark wine, so it has a nice retro look with the pale blue print, so it totally fits the theme of the whole thing.
And we printed those shirts ourselves in-house because we try to do everything ourselves as much as possible because I like that stuff. You know, it has that personalized touch to what we do. You can support the Indiegogo campaign, which is still ongoing. Because we hit our goal, as long as we receive at least one donation in a six-month period, that will be ongoing forever. And that's obviously for smaller donations. For those who might be listening that would like to make a larger donation, we're open to it. I recommend you reach out to us directly because there's some perks that can come with that depending what you want to do, including a private tour of the archive, and depending how much you give us, maybe a private screening in the archive for you and some buds and family members. So is there anything else you guys would like to talk about for the upcoming screening before we get out of here? And once again, Dusty Cans is an ongoing film screening series of 16mm film prints featuring cartoons, short documentaries, cultural films, musicals, home movies, trailers, commercials, silent films, and more. The next screening takes place this Sunday, January 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Emmaus Theater. Tickets are available now on Eventbrite as well as at the box office the day of the screening. They are $10, all ages. It's a family-friendly event. Bring out the kiddos if you like. Support a great place. They got the snack stand there. We'll have two long reels and a really awesome digital intermission in between. Another throwback. You'll have to wait to see until you get there. And we'll have a little film guide there for everyone that attends so you can see everything we played. And for those of you listening, please like and subscribe to this podcast to help it grow. We want this podcast to reach more people. We want people to know about all the amazing artistry and work being done here in Olihav Valley and beyond. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on Art Bazaar.